From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, I speak with syndicated columnist Joyce Maynard. Her weekly column, Domestic Affairs, is an ongoing chronicle of her life as a wife, mother, and writer in rural New Hampshire. Also today, I talk with private investigator Irwin Bly. Bly says his line of work isn't anything like his fictional counterparts on TV. Jazz critic Francis Davis reviews Three Windows, the new album featuring the Modern Jazz Quartet and the New York Chamber Symphony. And TV critic David Bianculli looks at Fox Television's latest offering, Werewolf. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. My guest is syndicated columnist Joyce Maynard. She was a reporter for the New York Times when she moved to rural New Hampshire to start a family. She tried to keep up her reporting, but decided it was hopeless to try to investigate prostitution while carrying around her infant. It was then she decided to make her children and her home her beat. Each week, Maynard writes a newspaper column about her home life titled Domestic Affairs. The focus of her column ranges from the acrobatics involved in making breakfast for five to her ambivalent feelings about her father, who was an alcoholic. A continuing theme throughout her work is the difficulty of combining motherhood and career. Maynard has been chronicling her life since 1972, when she wrote a cover story for the New York Times Magazine titled An 18-Year-Old Looks Back on Life. She was a college freshman at the time and spoke of her generation's unfulfilled expectations after the Vietnam War. Maynard's new book is titled Domestic Affairs, Enduring the Pleasures of Motherhood and Family Life. Welcome to Fresh Air, Joyce.
Hi, Terry.
Clear up a controversy for me. Pronounce your last name.
Maynard.
So we're bucking against the tide here.
No nerds in my family.
Okay. It seems to me what you're doing is finding a way to write about family life and a humorous way to write about family life without making family life sound like a sitcom.
Well, I hope so. I guess I'm hoping, too, that I'm finding, although I tell stories chiefly about my family and my children, the point of this book, certainly, and why anybody should read it is not to know them better, but because I'm looking always for the universal, the larger story that touches other people's experience as well.
Although I say that this is life that's not a sitcom, it amused me the way you sometimes feel like Donna Reed in the mornings when everybody's dashing out of the house after you've made them breakfast.
Well, I'm of that generation, and probably you are too, that grew up on Donna Reed show Leave It to Beaver, and I have indelibly etched in my mind this vision of mom that I don't come close to matching. I'm still sort of waiting to be like one of those mothers that I saw whose every hair is in place and who are always under control, never raise their voices to their children. And of course, they have a certain kind of child too who don't always match my own. And as much as I understand that that was fiction, that was television, it was still a shock, I think, for me. When I became a parent, not only because of television, but I think the general sense all around for women of my generation that they should be able to do everything, to discover just how much of a struggle it is.
Well, you tried that for a while before you decided to write at home about home life.
Yeah.
You tried when you had one infant to continue your life as a reporter. Why didn't that work?
I had imagined, and I think this was a pretty common syndrome during the 70s. Women in the aftermath of, or in the first wave of the aftermath of the women's movement, were led to feel a kind of responsibility to carry on absolutely as if being a mother had no bearing on their work life, probably more with greater toughness and determination than a lot of men. I remember, for instance, that when I left the New York Times for the reason of getting married and having kids, there were women who were very angry at the statement that that was making and then the backward steps that that seemed to suggest. But I did imagine, although I had left to have a child, that I would be able to carry on my work life with no discernible change. And what took me by surprise was not only the physical demands of a baby and how hard it is to leave them, find care you feel comfortable with, arrange for them, but that I myself was permanently a different person and my concerns were different. And rather than completely abandon the only work I've ever known, I made my home my beat, as I say in the book. And I attempted to find significance in the ordinary instead of, as a reporter does, the extraordinary.
Did you for a while feel like this was a sign of failure, the fact that you were giving up on the kind of reporting that you'd done before?
Oh, sure. And I feel sometimes a wistfulness still. You know, I would have friends in the city who would be jetting off to some war or other, and I would get a postcard from some exotic spot, not only just in work life, but my husband and I had many friends who were leading much freer lives than our own highly domesticated existence, and we'd see them go off on their adventures, and I would feel very homebound, very unadventuresome, rooted. And I guess I sometimes have had to work to look for where the adventure was in child raising. Increasingly, it's apparent to me.
The thing is that you make it more adventurous by writing about it.
Well, that's true.
Because you make it into something larger than it is. This always happens, I think, when you write about something or make a TV show about something.
I don't think I make it larger than it is, but because, I mean, I think it's as important as I say it is. But I do have the opportunity that people who are simply living it don't have, which is to sit down and analyze it. And often I don't know the significance until I've done that. Which is why I think it's sometimes helpful for people to read these stories and say, oh, yeah, that's what that was about.
Joyce Maynard is my guest. She writes a syndicated column called Domestic Affairs, which is also the title of her new book. For me, the most moving essay in your book is one about the last visit you made to your grandmother, and you brought with you your young daughter. And after that visit, you were thinking about the four generations of women in your family, yourself, your mother, your granddaughter, and your baby, your grandmother and your baby daughter. And I'd like to ask you to read a paragraph from that.
Sure, with
essay.
Pleasure. It's a paragraph, it's an essay really, about the way family patterns perpetuate themselves, and I see it every day of my life still. On the plane flying home with Audrey in my arms, I thought about mothers and daughters and the four generations of the family that I know most intimately. Every one of those mothers loves and needs her daughter more than her daughter will love or need her someday. And we are, each of us, the only person on earth who is quite so consumingly interested in our child. Sometimes, when she was a baby, I would kiss and hug Audrey so much she started crying, which is in effect what my grandmother was doing to my mother all her life. And what made my mother grieve, I knew, was not only that her mother would die in a day or two, but that once her mother was dead, there would never again be someone to love her in quite such an unreserved, unquestioning way. No one to believe that 50 years ago she could have put Shirley Temple out of a job. No one else who remembers the moment of her birth. She would only be a mother then, not a daughter anymore.
I want to pick up on something that you say in there, that mothers love and need daughters more than daughters love and need mothers. What made you think about that?
Well, that particular day, I know it was seeing feeling my mother's loss of her mother. But at the same time, the older my children grow, well, I'll backtrack and say that when they're babies, they just need you and want you. And then from the moment of their birth, they're beginning to cut first the cord and then a whole succession of other leave-takings and partings. And at some point, the switch occurs when I'm the one now, and it's already happening. It's happened with my daughter more and more. It's already happening even with my youngest son, that I'm the one who stays home and waits for him and hangs on his words to find out what happened at daycare or nursery school or the birthday party. We give out and give out and to our children, and they don't really give back to us. They give on to the next generation. It's a kind of love without strings. It's very different from marriage. I'm often aware of the fact that one can divorce a husband or wife in a way that you don't even think of it with a child. And it doesn't mean you love them less, but differently, that's for sure.
Now that you're a mother of three, do you relate to your own mother differently, especially in the light of this realization that you had that mothers love and need daughters more than daughters love and need mothers?
Well, I think I'm sure I'm not the first person who said that. I felt much more sympathy and understanding for my mother since I've had children. I carry my own childhood with me every day, both what I want to duplicate and what haunts me that I want to do differently. I sometimes hear my mother's voice coming through myself in a way that's a little scary, you know, just silly little phrases, you know, what you touch, you take, or, you know, that careful, your face might freeze in that position, or, you know, all the little sayings that we hated our mothers to say, you know, I can tell you need to go to bed, you're overtired, and then the child cries, and you see, I told you were overtired. I remember how I hated that one. It hurts me more than it hurts you. Spank you. Yes, I feel a kinship with the generation of parents. As whatever age you are, until you've had a child, unless you've had a child, you are still in the child generation, I think. It's, among other things, I think it's a fairly successful cure for a troubled childhood to become a parent. Then you can replace troubled parenthood with troubled childhood, if nothing else. The preeminent experience becomes being a parent and is no longer childhood.
So when you find yourself saying things to your children that your mother said to you, things that you swore you'd never say if you were a parent, do you stop yourself in shock and horror?
Well, I write about it. I write to the typewriter and write about it. The other thing that happens is I will hear my daughter speaking to her younger brothers in a voice that is me, you know, and I'll hear how I sound or how I sound to her, which is horrifying. Very dictatorial, you know, frequently and almost comically teacher-like. I mean, one has many different voices, but the great tricks about parenthood, I think, is that nothing is absolute and forever. I suppose maybe there are some, but I haven't encountered a lot of situations that I didn't get a fresh start on the next day. So if I hear my daughter speaking to her brothers in that voice that is me, I can change.
You said that your mother raised you to be a mother, and I wonder if you feel like you're raising your daughter to be a mother, especially in light of the fact of all the new options that women have now in choosing how to spend their lives.
No, I'd say she's her own person, and I'm happy to say that. In fact, just the other night, we were discussing, I think my youngest son, Willie, who's three, was talking about the girl that he's planning to marry, and Audrey began saying, well, if I get married someday, not when, which was a phrase that I never uttered. It never occurred to me. And I think that's healthy.
As much as you really love parenting and being able to stay home and do your column there.
Oh, I hate parenting often.
Well, that's what I'm coming to. The fact that you actually also really hate it, and you've described several times where you're close to a nervous breakdown.
I love my children. I hate parenting often.
But you say something that we've all heard or said or both, which is, I'm just a servant around here. Mm-hmm. No one appreciates me.
Mm-hmm. I dress in rags while you wear a spree. That's another of my lines that seems to come up a lot.
What are some of the things that move you to saying that, where you're at the point of saying, no one appreciates me?
Mess. I must say mess around the house, and picking up seems to do it. I did. There was a recent occasion that I can't say I'm particularly proud of, when I finally just decided that I would announce that I would be eating my meals in another room in the kitchen, since clearly the family regarded me as a servant. And that, of course, then wails were broken forth from all parties. The situations at this point are often my children are great. I have wonderful children, of course. They're perfect. They're young. And so right now, my issues tend to be sort of physical ones. I'm at the Jane Fonda stage of mothering, you know, when it's a workout. I haven't yet got to that age of, I don't have a pre-adolescent or an adolescent yet. I don't have the kind of cerebral dilemmas as much, probably, as a parent of older children, although I'm beginning to see them even with my precocious 9-year-old.
Sex, drugs, and rock and roll haven't entered the picture yet.
It, for me now, it's things like getting three children suited up in snowsuits and then the third one needs to go to the bathroom. It's that kind of thing. It is just the constant, or I hope that this won't shock your listeners to hear that 2 days before I set out on this trip, which is, you know, about my book all around the country, our family discovered that we were totally infested with head lice, which means a kind of examination of your life that, of course, I do all the time in one way on paper, but this was the realities. Every sheet, every stuffed animal, every item of clothing fumigated, every head, of course, and then each lice egg, I have to say, removed one by one from the little heads. And of course, the little heads are wiggling quite a bit as it's happening. So that's the sort of moment that leads me to announce that I'm having a nervous breakdown. And I did announce that. It's not the first time they've heard that.
And no, what's added to the seriousness of that when you feel that, it's, you can also be thinking, if it wasn't for all of you, I would be a star reporter.
That I wouldn't
of what
do.
What I've given up for you. Do you
that
do
I wouldn't
you feel
do.
That?
There are a few just forbidden things to say. Mm-hmm. I mean, I choose my artillery carefully, I would say. That might really hurt.
Now, why would you say, I'm eating in the other room because you treat me like a servant, and not say, think
see.
Of what I've sacrificed
What's
for you?
What's the difference there? For one thing, that's not how I feel. Mm-hmm. I do feel that they treat me like a servant sometimes, and that's correct, they do. But I am doing what I want to do, and I would never want them to feel that they had taken away from my life more than they had enriched it. It's, I mean, it's actually, I wrote professionally for quite a few years before I had children, and I was much less productive then. And I often think about that. I look back on those years longingly, and I think about the novels that I would write now if I had that kind of time. And I could write an encyclopedia is how I feel. But I didn't have, whatever freedoms I had, I did not have the kind of drive and motivation to say something that I feel I do now. So as much as they take away, and they do, they have also given me a reason to do the work that I do, and a kind of passion for it that I didn't, for my life, period, that I didn't have before.
Writer Joyce Maynard is my guest. Her syndicated column and her new book are both titled Domestic Affairs. We're going to take a short break and we'll be back in a few seconds. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live from WHYY in Philadelphia and is distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is Joyce Maynard. She writes a syndicated column about her life as a wife and mother of three in rural New Hampshire. Her book and her column are both titled Domestic Affairs. Her children, by the way, are aged 9, 5, and 3. Her daughter's the oldest, and the other two are our sons. I think you mentioned a few of the letters that you've gotten from readers, and the funniest one, I thought, you might not have thought this was funny, was the writer who said, after reading your column, I've decided to get a vasectomy.
Oh, sure. A man. Well, of course a man. And I'm sure he made the right decision. It's funny because the I knew exactly which columns he must have been thinking about. And those same stories that led him to the vasectomy clinic, I thought were wonderful examples of the richness of parenthood. But it just shows that it's all in the eye of the beholder. I get wonderful mail. It's one of the reasons why I write the column. At the moment, I have a fascinating batch of mail because for the first time, I asked readers to write into, I mean, they do anyway, but I asked them to write into me on a particular subject. The subject was adultery. And I have to say that I did this before Dear Abby did, and that I think I got a higher class of response. Very articulate letters, if not in her million numbers. But anyway, I'm sitting now surrounded by about 800 wonderful letters from the same people who, you know, who write to me about carpools and daycare centers and babysitters, writing to me about love affairs. Not, I think, I mean, it was what I was kind of guessing anyway But it was fascinating to hear, and important, I think, to hear that these are mothers out there.
That brings up something that I wanted to ask you about, which is that I know a lot of women and a lot of men feel that before they decide to become parents, they really have to ask themselves if they would be willing and able to be a single parent, because a lot of people don't have that much faith in the power of marriage to endure.
Huh.
And
wow, I never asked myself that question.
You never did.
But I didn't. I didn't embark on marriage with any degree of caution or circumspection. It is my temperament to wake up every morning and say, and this has not made my husband's life easier, as you can imagine, do I want to be married today? Pretty much, do I like my life? And I think that's dangerous and not a good idea. Luckily, I on the mornings when, and they occur when I say, I don't want to be married today, I am able to make that leap of faith that there will again be a day when I want to be married, and it gets me through. And I take very seriously the notion of staying married. It's one of the things that this book is about, really, is the struggle of marriage, too. I think the children place, well, there are so many pressures on a marriage, but one of them, for sure, is this, the very same thing that gets us into the marriage often gets us out. You know, my husband and I were brought together, among other things, by a passionate desire to raise children together, to have a family. It seemed to both of us like an extraordinary adventure and challenge, and something that we do very well together. However, I disagree with him on other things often. I never do with him as a parent. But by the same token, it has meant that we've been so consumingly involved with just getting through the days that it sometimes is hard, and easy, rather, to lose sight of one another. I see a light at the end of the tunnel, but certainly an area that I address in the book is that. That I've witnessed the breakup of a lot of my friends' marriages over the now 10 years, 10 years the other day that I've been married, and it's sobering. I never do with the smug sense of one who has it all nailed down, but I desperately, I think, quite apart from the fact that I love my husband, everybody knows that's not enough. I think we both take very seriously the notion of giving our children two parents married to each other. It's increasingly a rarity.
Well, your parents divorced after you left home, after
right.
you were old enough
right.
to leave home. Did that strengthen your resolve to not separate? I'm acting as if you're on the verge of separating, which...
No.
Didn't mean it that way.
No. Well, I came from a troubled home, long before my parents separated. I have often found myself, practically proclaiming, we will be happy if it kills us. It's a top priority for me to be a happy family. Of course, it doesn't work that way. That's not how you get there. But I am so much a product of my childhood that I can never live one day imagining that we are doing anything other than forming who our children will be when they're adults. And I take that with enormous seriousness.
You started writing professionally when you were still almost a child yourself. Your cover story in the New York Times, summing up the feelings of your generation, was published when you were 18 years old.
Yeah, I'm embarrassed even to hear it described that way. And, of course, it's a correct description. Presumes to make statements at the age of 18 that one wouldn't think of at age 33.
What were some of the things that you said in there?
I spoke of, I'm sure I said we of everything, we, my generation, and I got a lot of angry letters, and I deserve to, that we were weary, that we had seen all of life at a very early age. I was ready for retirement, I said. I actually went on to write a description of the life that I hoped I would live someday, which is not unlike the life that I am living, down to the number of children. Not that I necessarily consider that number closed out, but was still very full of the 60s, the experience of growing up in the 60s. And I think that being as much of a television child as I was formed a great deal by national events rather than personal events. Now, I wouldn't presume to speak for anybody other than myself, and I really, I tell just the stories that I feel I have a business telling. And if there are larger implications, it's for other people to find them.
How is your writing going to change as your children get older? You have to worry not only about, quote, empty nest syndrome, but about your subject matter leaving home.
Right. I don't really worry about that one. I do worry about my subject matter. Well, I was going to say I worry about my subject matter being able to read, which is now the case of 33% of my subject matter. Well, I don't just write about my children, but I say that and then I take it back because although only one of my children does now read, I'm painfully well aware of the fact that even those who don't will someday read what I write and that I must begin to pull back from them in their lives, and I am. It's one reason, for instance, why I asked that question in my column. I'm trying to go beyond my own home area because I don't think it's a good and healthy way for them to grow up feeling that they are constantly being observed. It's hard enough to be a teenager when your mother isn't writing about you, but I don't think it's really fair for a teenager to be written about in the way that I did write about my babies.
Recently, your town was one of the towns that was singled out as a possible home for a nuclear waste site, and you became very active in trying to prevent that from happening. And you wrote in your book that you did it because you thought to not do it would set a bad example for your children. What did you mean by that?
Well, we were looking at the prospect that our town, this home that we'd spent the last 10 years building, would be confiscated, that virtually our entire community would be taken for a high-level nuclear waste dump, first on the globe, first on the face of the earth. And the impulse for many people was to leave. To just bail out because at best we'd be looking at years of uncertainty while we waited to see, you know, if we did get to become a dump. And one of the compelling arguments that for my husband and me for staying and fighting it out, which we did, was what kind of a vision of life would we transmit to our children if what kind of message would be given them? I think every day as a parent, you wake up thinking, my actions are significant. What I do is how I look at the world is how they're going to look at the world, and it makes you think twice.
So you wanted them to show that you could take action against
at the same time that you know that we were doing this for them. It also meant agonizing amount of absence from them. It's hard now to convey what it was like, this town under siege, but. We were every night out at meetings and demonstrations of one sort or another. We had been told that we had 90 days before a trial and that basically we would have no say on whether our homes were confiscated or not. It was a period of semi-hysteria for many people.
And so your town is in the clear for now, though, right?
For now, although the nuclear waste continues to be made and it's got to go somewhere, of course.
Joyce Maynard, I want to thank you very much for sharing some about your life and about your writing with us. Thanks for being here.
It's a pleasure.
My guest has been Joyce Maynard. She's a syndicated columnist. Her column and her new book are both titled Domestic Affairs. Her book is subtitled Enduring the Pleasures of Motherhood and Family Life. It's published by Times Books. My name's Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with Peter Collier and David Horowitz. As editors of Ramparts magazine in the 60s, they were leading theorists of the New Left. They've since undergone a political conversion and now describe themselves as neoconservatives. So I hope you can join us. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio. From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, private investigator Irwin Bly describes what it's really like to tail someone or go on a stakeout. Also today, the Modern Jazz Quartet has teamed up with the New York Chamber Orchestra for their latest album, Three Windows. Jazz critic Francis Davis has a review. Television critic David Bianculli looks at Werewolf, the latest program offered by the fledgling Fox Network. And we have the latest news from National Public Radio in Washington. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. Now here's the news. This is Fresh Air. Our jazz critic Francis Davis has a review of a new album by the Modern Jazz Quartet. The group's been together for 35 years, minus the seven-year sabbatical they took in the 1970s. Francis says their latest recording reestablishes them as one of the foremost jazz chamber groups.
You might recognize what you're hearing as a new version of Django, John Lewis's best-known composition for the Modern Jazz Quartet. It's from Three Windows, a new release marking the MJQ's return to Atlantic Records and their reunion with Neshua Erdogan, who produced most of the two dozen albums that the MJQ recorded for Atlantic between 1956 and 1974. For the occasion, John Lewis, the MJQ's pianist and music director, has opened up several of his compositions to accommodate the 17-piece New York Chamber Symphony. The older compositions to which Lewis has added strings are the venerable Django, which the MJQ first recorded in 1954, and the album's title track, which the MJQ debuted as part of Lewis's score to Roger Vadim's 1957 film No Sun in Venice. The album also includes Kansas City Breaks and A Day in Dubrovnik, two more recent Lewis compositions which he has recorded previously, although not with the MJQ. Encounter in Cagnes is the album's only new piece, but it too sounds familiar because it borrows its catchy theme from 2 Degrees East, 3 Degrees West, a Lewis blues from the 1950s. Now granted, a composer has the right to tinker with his works, no matter the consternation of his critics. But John Lewis's greatest gift as a composer has always been his sense of proportion. It seems to me that, in enlarging the works on Three Windows, Lewis has sacrificed some of the intimacy that made these works so appealing to begin with. The one significant exception is A Day in Dubrovnik, a three-part work that qualifies as one of Lewis's most successful efforts in writing for strings. This is the first movement. Thank you. From the album Three Windows, the song-like first movement of A Day in Dubrovnik, performed by the Modern Jazz Quartet, vibist Milt Jackson, bassist Percy Heath, drummer Connie Kay, and pianist and composer John Lewis. They're playing with the New York Chamber Symphony. I wish we had time for the rest of A Day in Dubrovnik, in particular the lengthy second movement with its magisterial string passages and its conflicting moods of romantic longing and foreboding. A Day in Dubrovnik outshines everything else on Three Windows, but that doesn't mean I can't recommend the album in its entirety. It's just that I tend to judge the Modern Jazz Quartet by Olympian standards, not by the lesser standards I might apply to another group. The MJQ is frequently credited with bringing a formal elegance to jazz, and I confess I'm never quite sure what people mean by that. Since image is everything to some people, they could be talking about the tuxedos the group often wears on stage. It would be more to the point to say this. In his writing for the MJQ, John Lewis reconciles a composer's desire for predetermination with the improviser's need for free will, a miracle only a handful of jazz composers have pulled off with any consistency. Moreover, Lewis assigns ensemble passages and solo choruses equal weight. This restores a necessary balance lacking in most modern jazz, where the solos are generally all that counts. In that sense, the most remarkable aspect of this version of A Day in Dubrovnik is the illusion it gives of having been conceived as a discourse between the Modern Jazz Quartet and the New York Chamber Symphony. A Day in Dubrovnik is a masterpiece by any standard, even by the high standard I apply to the MJQ.
Our jazz critic Francis Davis is the author of In the Moment, Jazz in the 1980s. He also writes for The Atlantic and the Philadelphia Inquirer. He reviewed Three Windows, a new album by the Modern Jazz Quartet with the New York Chamber Symphony. This is Fresh Air. My guest is private investigator Irwin Bly. Our image of private eyes come from detective novels, movies, and television. The fictional detective moves in a world of seediness, explosive violence, and wild sexual adventures. But Irwin Bly says he operates in a less dramatic workaday world. He handles divorce cases, insurance claims, missing persons estates, and white-collar crimes. Bly is the subject of the book called Bly Private Eye, written by Nicholas Pileggi. A new paperback edition has just been published. And Bly has co-authored his own book called Secrets of a Private Eye. It's a how-to book for people who want to act as their own private investigator. Irwin Bly has been a private eye for 30 years. I asked him how he got started.
While I was going to college on Long Island, a friend of mine was an investigator for an insurance company. And one day had asked me, come with me. I'd like, you know, I want some company. And we went out on an investigation, an insurance claim. And I was kind of fascinated with it. He was interviewing people, looking for witnesses, attempting to determine what really happened to you. I said, you know, this is something I'd like to get into.
You're a detective. Our image of detectives is of people who carry guns. Do you carry a gun?
I'm licensed to carry a gun, and on occasion I do. For the most part, I do not. The gun, it's not a necessary situation. Now, the physical violence, let's say we're doing a surveillance. I cut someone off. You're more liable to become in a fist fight over the car than because you're driving, and you're not driving as you normally would. Well, someone's going to get in front of you. Go ahead. I can't let him in front of me because that'll be the third car and that subject's going to be lost and I'm going to lose. Once you lose the subject, you're finished. And there's something else. On television, you see them chasing the subject. Well, in the private eye or the private investigator, when he's chasing it, that job is over. If I was training you My comment to you would be, if you've got to let him go, let him go. If you lose him, lose the subject. I can pick it up if you're forced under the circumstances to drop it, or if you lost him. Now, you can take a situation where you're doing an investigation, and you say, well, what do you mean by drop him? If I was doing an investigation, a surveillance, take, say, an apartment house that has a doorman, and I've been there for 4 hours out front, and my subject comes out, I got to be careful with that doorman. That doorman has seen me for 4 hours. May or may not. Hopefully he won't. I'll be in a position. But he might. I might be, have to be in a position where I couldn't avoid sitting in a certain area. Now, I might let that subject go because I'm concerned that that doorman will alert the subject. Certainly the doorman's loyalty is not to me. It's to the tenant.
Say you have to wait outside somebody's building for them to come out, and or you're waiting in your car or whatever. How can you wait there for a long time without looking like someone there's, really suspicious?
Okay, there's several things you can do. One thing you can do is, instead of sitting behind the wheel, sit on the driver's side.
Looks like you're waiting for the driver.
Exactly. You're waiting for someone. And you can also look at your watch and be disgusted. You know, you've got a play act, but you've been sitting there for several hours. There are props that you can keep in your car that can change what you look like. Different coat. A dog is marvelous. Kids are terrific.
You take your kids with you sometimes
on
a stakeout?
Sure. They're jumping up and down in there, and you're pulling up, and nobody expects it.
If you've got your kids in the car, how do you teach them to not say, Daddy, Daddy, there's the guy you're following?
I don't tell them there's the guy I'm following. You know, my son, who's now 16, when he was 6, 7, 8 years old, 9 years old, he could call someone on the phone and elicit info. If I wanted to find out if someone was home, for the most part, of course, you call up and you speak. Because that call, that can be wiped out of your memory. But hang-ups, may not. You got to be a little careful. So what I do is I don't tell the kids what we're doing. And my son can call up if I wanted it. On a surveillance, I don't tell him. But let's say I wanted to find out, is this particular individual home? And I would tell, he would call up and I say, this is, I want you to find out if so-and-so, and I would coach him. And he would get engaged them in conversation. He's marvelous. You'd hear this little voice, oh, is Tommy home? Well, no, he's not. Is this his daddy? Is this so-and-so? And, and it's terrific the way he can do it because he's been trained from the beginning.
What do you do when you have to heed nature's call on a stakeout and you don't want to leave because you can't leave?
Well, you do the obvious. Various investigators handle it in different ways. Street or a bottle. But I've been on surveillances that have stayed in a car for maybe 30 hours, 40. I can remember once, this fellow who used to work with me quite often, we were in that car for almost 2 days. In fact, I think we were. And so what do you do? Well, at that point, there's two of you. You try to get a local restaurant, and you try to, but it's certainly not very pleasant. And when you see a stakeout on television or in the movies, and they're sitting there extremely refreshed, the car is very neat. The only thing I think that was close to was the French Connection. You've got to see a surveillance car, almost every one of them. Coffee cups, sandwich wrappers, cameras thrown around, binoculars, maybe a hat in the back, a different coat, and you've been there. You're living with it, and you're also exhausted.
You pride yourself on knowing how to mastermind your way through bureaucracies to get computerized information from data banks that are supposed to be secret. Should we all be worrying that our secret information that
privacy?
The insurance companies have, the stuff that's supposed to be private, is it really?
Privacy is a myth. It's non-existent. I believe, because I want to, that it may exist. You may believe that it may exist. It's non-existent. It's not here. Why? You're born. The first thing they do, take your footprint. We're on our way. Next thing we got the school records. Next thing we got is credit cards. Next thing we're involved in a lawsuit. Next thing we're engaged, so I got the blurb of your whole family and your whole background. It goes on and on and on.
So if you know how to get the information, it's available.
Yes, it's available. The trick to it, if it's not even a trick, it's a technique. When you're attempting to obtain information on an individual, one, of course, you've got to know where to go for it. But also speak to them in their language. Don't call the bank and say, can you tell me how much so-and-so has in their account? No, I cannot tell you how much so-and-so has in their account. Call the bank and say, listen, I've got this check. Is this account any good? Is it in three figures? Has any accommodations been made? I mean, what you've done is you triggered them that they automatically answer. They don't think because that's the way they talk to each other all day long. Now, you didn't do anything illegal. All you're doing is talking to them in their terminology. If I went into the bank and I look around and I see now there's three people who can help me with the information I want. Now, it's up to me to pick who I think is going to give me the information. Sometimes I'll walk in and you're a private investigator. And most people love to talk about being a private investigator because every night they're seeing it, every single night. I want to use that to elicit information. I'll take every advantage that I can.
You've made it clear that you think that the world the fictional private eye lives in is indeed fictional, very unlike the kind of world you operate in. But what are some of your favorite detectives from the world of movies, TVs, and TV and books?
Well, some of my favorites in the world. Okay, I like James Gardner. But this is fiction. I'm not relating them because I've never seen the closest thing to real life, I think, was, as I said before, and it wasn't a private eye. It was the movie, The French Connection. We don't do the chase, but like when he was on the surveillance and he had the cup and it was coffee and it was lousy and he poured it out and they're sitting in this great restaurant and you're eating a slice of pizza. Well, that's more realistic. No, that's more closer to it.
Well, thank you for talking with us about your real-life private eye life.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it.
Erwin Bly is a private investigator and the co-author of Secrets of a Private Eye. You're listening to Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel, who co-hosts the program, is joining us from Washington. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
What stories are you covering today?
Well, we're following more U.S. defense policy in the Persian Gulf, what U.S. warplanes were doing over the Gulf, and news about South Korean political prisoners, how many there are, who they are.
The Iran-Contra hearings resume tomorrow with Oliver North taking the stand. Will you be looking ahead today?
Indeed. We have a little profile of Oliver North and also a special report by Alan Berlow about the week in November when the trip to Tehran by McFarlane was first revealed. And as members of the administration tried to figure out what to tell the public, were they trying to inform or trying to cover up?
Well, thanks, Robert. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The Fox Broadcasting Company introduced its first program over a year ago, and they're continuing to bring out new ones. Our television critic David Bianculli has a preview of a new Fox series called Werewolf.
The first program unveiled by the Fox Broadcasting Company was The Late Show starring Joan Rivers. It was a bomb. 1 year later, it's The Late Show not starring Joan Rivers, which is a definite improvement. Then, in April of this year, Fox started rolling out its Sunday night shows. Married with Children, The Tracy Ullman Show, 21 Jump Street, and Duet. In May, they added Mr. President, starring George C. Scott. And this month, four new Fox shows premiere opposite network reruns. Those four shows are Karen's Song, which stars Patty Duke as a woman who gets involved with a much younger man, and Down and Out in Beverly Hills, based on the hit movie, but with a different cast. Same dog, though. And The New Adventures of Beans Baxter, about a teenage spy. And finally, the one that premieres nationally this weekend, Werewolf. Werewolf is part The Howling, part The Fugitive, and part An American Werewolf in London. Like the other shows by this young network, it's aimed squarely at the youth market, but it's fun for older viewers, too. Werewolf is a well-made horror program, But that shouldn't be too much of a surprise. A network called Fox ought to be able to make a good show about a wolf. The idea behind Werewolf is to take an innocent college kid, played by John York, and expose him to what I guess you'd call the werewolf virus. He's got a girl who loves him, but he has to rule out any more moonlight swims. There's a lot of werewolf point-of-view photography and snazzy special effects by makeup artist Rick Baker. All of this, like the rock music on the soundtrack, is reminiscent of an American Werewolf in London. Baker did the effects for that movie, too, so even the wolf may be a bit familiar. It's a new improved model, though, and way above the norm for TV special effects. This TV werewolf series also borrows from the movie The Howling, because it features a kind of king werewolf. He's played by Chuck Connors, who used to be the Rifleman, and Connors has a blast with this role. He plays him as a werewolf version of the salty sea captain in Jaws, but he laughs like a hyena. The good werewolf has to hunt the bad werewolf down and kill him to be free of the werewolf curse. Meanwhile, a bounty hunter is after the kid, so there's a lot of chasing going on. So it's like The Fugitive, except there's a king werewolf instead of a one-armed man, and a bounty hunter instead of Lieutenant Gerard. Oh yeah, and the fugitive hero is a werewolf, not a doctor. But it's fun, and it's got just the right blend of scares and laughs. Here's a showdown scene in which the hero finally catches up with the king werewolf. But the bad guy, instead of being nasty, invites the younger werewolf to dinner.
I don't need to wait for the sign. I already know the cycle has begun. I can feel it in me, strong. And tonight, we feast, the both of us, on all the unsuspecting, together.
Okay, so the howl sounds a little like Count Floyd on Second City TV, but it's enjoyable to watch, and that seems to be the common denominator for all the Fox shows so far. Werewolf is the best of the four new Fox series, but Fox still has a higher percentage of watchable shows than any network but NBC. The Tracy Ullman Show is right up there with Saturday Night Live, and I like Married with Children more each week. The fourth network idea sounded crazy at first, but now it seems crazy like a fox. Or a werewolf.
David Bianculli is television critic for the New York Post.
Well, it's a marvelous night for a moon dance with the stars up above in your eyes. A fantabulous night to make romance neath the cover of October skies. With all the leaves on the trees are falling to the sound of the breezes that blow. You know, I'm trying to please to the calling.
Here's a preview of our next program. On our next show, I'll speak with writer Susan Cheever. Her memoir of her father, John Cheever, was nominated for the National Book Critics Circle Award in 1984. She's written a new novel. It's titled Doctors and Women. Also, rock historian Ed Ward will profile The Great Society, the band Grace Slick sang with before the Jefferson Airplane. And book critic John Leonard will review Don't Tread on Me, the selected letters of S.J. Perlman. So I hope you can join us. And we want to welcome a station new to Fresh Air, WLRN, in Miami and Fort Lauderdale. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
The senior producer for today's show is Fred Landerl. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Doherty is the production assistant. Our engineer is Ron Barron. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. Fresh Air's theme music is composed and performed by Jackie Byard. My name's Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.